you know, our phones are ringing off the hook. People are joining the campaign and stepping up. And let's be clear, Canadians want clean energy. Canadians, many of them, are very embarrassed about what our government is doing internationally. So our movement is growing, and so far, we have slowed down all of these pipelines and the expansion.
What's the alternative?
Well, the alternative for Canada is not only clean energy, renewable energy, which now we can build at scale, we know that, but it's also supporting other aspects of our economy. Because when you support only one aspect of your economy, the most capital-intensive sector in the country, then it starts to destroy your manufacturing base, your service industry, your tourism industry. We need a diversified economy in Canada, and that's entirely possible.
Zipporah Berman, I want to thank you for being with us. Leading environmental activist in Canada, she's campaigned for decades around clean energy. Former co-director of Greenpeace International's Climate Union, now focused on stopping tar sands extraction. That does it for our show. We have two job openings at Democracy Now!, a Linux Systems Administrator and Annual Giving Manager. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today's guest is the infamous climate activist Bill McKimmons, his own self. He'll be in to talk about 350.org, oil from Alberta's controversial tar sands project, and his new book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist.
The KBOO Book and Record Sale is back. KBOO's annual Book and Record Sale happens Saturday, September 28th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Not only will there be fabulous books, CDs, and vinyl to grab at ridiculously low prices, but it will also be a madcap fun community event. There will be KBOO DJs spinning live all day and baked goods available for a donation. All proceeds from the day benefits KBOO, your community radio station. It all happens at the Musicians Union at 325 Northeast 20th on Saturday, September 28th. That's 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. Questions? Contact Ani at volunteer@kboo.org. For more information, check out kboo.fm.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks, KBOO, for 45 years, yes, 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. Friends of KBOO can be reached at
3:33. Blues. I'm really all confused. I'm about to lose my very mind. It always worry me all the time. These blues will make you cry. Feel just like you don't want to scream. Of course the cart was hard and it almost killed me up. But just to leave it go, boy, it was my cup. I've got those cold card blues till I really don't know what to do.
Yeah, Louis Armstrong. Hey.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah, he is. All right, KBOO 90.7 FM. That's what you're listening to here in Portland, Argram. And this is the Abe and Joe
here
Talk.
In what and where?
To ya, blah, blah. This is. The Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and me, Joe Uris. Number to call, 231-8187. Today at 8:30, that's a half an hour from now, we have Bill McKibben.
We do. That's pretty exciting.
It is exciting. I'm excited. He's going to be live. He's going to be in the studio.
He is.
And tonight, he's going to be at the Newmark Theater at 7:30 for Powell's Books, talking about his brand new book, Oil and Honey, which I read and is really very interesting book.
Well, tell us the subtitle of that book, because that'll shed a little light.
Oh, yes. The Education of an Unlikely Activist.
Yeah, basically, it describes his transition from an establishment figure to an eco-rebel. It's pretty inspiring stuff.
Well, it is. And I'm going to want to ask him about, well, what about, you know, what about the 99% and all that kind of stuff? The hard questions that go with the environmental improvements that need to be done. Not that fixing the environment is an easy problem. Anyway, we're going to have him here at half an hour. And meanwhile, you can call us and talk to us and lecture us and hector us and make our lives miserable.
Yeah, I think we should set up Mr. McKibben's arrival, shall we?
How do we do that?
Why don't you talk a little about the guy and his work?
Why don't you do that?
I will do that. He's been a writer for more than 20 years now. His first book, The End of Nature, published in 1989, essentially is regarded as the first book about global warming written for a layman's audience, for a wide audience. And since then, he's gone on to write many, many more. He's well-known in academic circles and political circles. In 2011, he led a massive protest, or maybe not led it, but was part of a massive protest in front of the White House against the Keystone XL pipeline. He was imprisoned along with more than 1,000 other people that day. And he has identified the Keystone pipeline as a turning point in our fossil fuel addiction.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait to find out from him. I'm very suspicious of Obama. I think he's going to allow the pipeline.
Yeah, we'll see. McKibben is actually quoted in a recent New Yorker magazine article, and I really encourage you to read that, and I'll dig up the title of that here pretty soon, about Obama raising money in California. And there's a growing consensus now that environmental politics is good politics. There's enough people who identify as green now that Obama need not fear the repercussions if he actually enacts some of the things he's been describing in his rhetoric in terms of the environment. So here's hoping.
Well, I also hope I wish Obama well. I haven't been impressed thus far with his environmentalism, but you know, he's a conscious human being, and he for a while was very resistant to the idea of global warming. I mean, not to the idea, but to the idea that it would happen.
Really? I thought he was one of the guys. He was not a global warming denier. However limp his politics may be with regard to the environment, he has said the right things.
Well, he said the right things about a lot of stuff, but you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's really at the heart of the problem with this president. He says all the right things, but he does very few of the right things.
Right. He's waiting for the moment.
Well, most politicians in his shoes would say the moment probably came somewhere after his reelection.
Well,
so shortly after his reelection.
It all went wrong when they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize, I think. You know. Well, once you've got that, what do you need? All right.
The article in the New Yorker is called "The President and the Pipeline" by Brian Lizza, published on the 16th of this month. I really encourage you to read that.
Yeah, and in this half hour, I would like to hear from people who have thoughts on the question of global warming and thoughts perhaps on McKibben and his work, and also on the XL pipeline. If you have a thought, perhaps you wish to deny. This is a good time to deny. 231-8187. But I've got a lot of stuff I want to talk about. I think that one of the most interesting conundrums of the movement is the failure of it, the environmental movement, mm-hmm. to effectively link up with the 99% issue. That is all the unemployment in this country, all the poverty in this country, which is huge given our wealth. And how can, and it seems to me obvious but yet ignored, how can we exploit, maybe that's not the right word, how can we use the fact that there's many unemployed people and there's many things that need to be done that would make this country more powerful, which is some people's concern, a better place to live, which is my concern. For example, why not have high-speed rail? A huge governmental investment would be necessary, just as was the case with the original Transcontinental Railroad. Why not have a conversion to solar and wind-powered power? Another example of something where government funding together with private funding could create an environmentally sound world for us in the United States and would free us ultimately from a lot of our logically, we insist, necessary imperialist behaviors with regard to the Middle East and elsewhere. Anyway.
You're both right and wrong. What? With your little diatribe there.
What? What do you mean
both
wrong?
Both right and wrong.
What?
I think you're wrong that the link has, that we have made no link between the 99% movement and the environmental movement. When Occupy Wall Street sprang into existence a few years ago, there was a very, very strong, very clearly articulated environmental plank among the principles that the movement laid out.
Well, that's true.
It's there.
It's there.
Yeah, where that connection has been made, of course, is with the people who operate the levers of policy. That's what we haven't seen.
Well, in fact, the people who operate the levers of policy seem to be operating purely on the notion, and this is something I'm going to want to ask McGibbon, the notion that it's that somehow there's a magical way that we won't have a consequence out of this global warming. well, look, you're rich. Let's say you're rich. Let's say you're really rich. You have several billion dollars, mm-hmm. right? You're in the Forbes really rich class, mm-hmm. right? You have children, you have grandchildren, you might even have great-grandchildren. Do you not feel concern for their future? And if you do, why the hell are you doing stuff that's clearly contradictory to the interests, the best interests of those future generations?
Allow me to play the cynic for just a moment.
Okay, why don't you play the cynic for just a moment?
All right, if I'm one of these people,
yeah.
I have a few billion dollars.
Yeah.
I've got a penthouse apartment in Lower Manhattan. I've got a summer place in the Hamptons. I've got a house in Paris. I've got a vacation place in the South Pacific. I'm maybe thinking, yeah, global warming, eh, so what? I got a lot of money now. I'm a very powerful person. I have enough resources that myself and all my descendants for the foreseeable future will be just fine. I don't really care. Whatever happens, I will have the resources to make sure that myself and my progeny are just fine. In fact, I might even be able to strengthen my position in the wake of global environmental catastrophe.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes time to build a seawall across the Golden Gate in California, I might just invest in that. When it comes time to both relocate and violently suppress millions of poor people in Bangladesh when the Ganges River starts rising, I might be able to invest in that. Yeah, and as Engineer Steve just whispered in my ear, you've got your own escape helicopter. In fact, a fleet of them. So, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people who see global warming as, you know, perhaps an unfortunate consequence of global capitalism for some. But if you're in the right sort of position, you can just ride that sucker out.
So you think it's potentially a class issue?
Oh, it not potentially. It is a class issue. And you've heard of the term social Darwinism, which came into vogue during the last great period of inequality, the Gilded Age of the late 1800s.
Right.
This might be the ultimate expression of that idea. If you're wealthy enough and well-positioned enough, your genes will be passed on because you're not one of the unfortunate billions who gets drowned out by rising sea levels. If you got enough money, you can go right on reproducing while the poor die by the millions.
Oh.
Social Darwinism, baby.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, yeah, social Darwinism. All right, I think we should take some calls. Again, Bill McKibben will be with us in 15 minutes. 231-8187. Jeremy, you're on the air.
I don't know if you know, but someone just dropped an F-bomb. I get cut off when I do that irregularly.
No,
but,
nobody dropped an F-bomb.
No, no.
Drive this effer out. I literally, while I was on hold, it may have been bleeped by somebody else. Anyway, I like F-bombs. I'm sorry you're not allowed to use them, but I thought it was amusing.
Okay.
Anyway, there was a really great, if people don't want to bother reading his books, which I don't, but there was a really good interview with him in, of all places, Street Roots, probably a week or two ago in a car.
You know, actually, I'm going to let you continue, Jeremy, but I just want to give a shout-out to Street Roots, which I think is a great newspaper.
Well, it was particularly great because this was, it was not, I mean, it's kind of a choice plum to get an interview with McKibben in a tiny little community newspaper, and it was very well done. It was fairly short, and boy, it got me to go up to Longview, Washington, to a protest.
Yeah, I saw you there getting on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, which was, by the way, a fabulous protest. And there will be another one, I believe, 2 weeks from whatever July, October 9th is.
Uh-huh.
I guess that's 2 weeks from tomorrow. and that'll be in Vancouver, and hopefully within no later than next Monday, I will have posters up, provided I get a few other people to commit to a bike caravan. I, of course, at 61 will not ride in pouring rain, but hopefully the younger people will, and I will ride if it's not pouring rain, and hopefully there'll be a significant presence suggesting.
No, that, I think I think it's great that you're doing that. I think the idea of poster distribution by bike is wonderful, and I think it's important that people understand that we are here in Oregon struggling against the railroad pipelines, the coal trains that we're going to go through our neighborhoods and our area.
Right, and one of the things that was that you know came out on your show last week, 200 coal, up to 200 coal trains a day. I mean, that's just astonishing to me. I have chronic respiratory issues, and I don't think they're going to be improved by that.
I doubt it very much.
One other thing I wanted to say from the McKibben interview.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll mention it again, but he refers to these multi-billionaires, whatever, all these people, as they are much more radical than anybody else on the planet. They are so extreme that they have chosen to destroy the planet.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, it is pretty wild. I wonder if it's really true.
And by the way, Abe, since I come from Manhattan, the standard pied-à-terre for the 0.001% is not in Lower Manhattan; it's on Park Avenue.
Oh well. Anyway, sorry about that.
That's all right. Don't worry about it.
Anyway, you'll never be there, Abe. It doesn't matter.
Ain't that the truth?
Okay, thanks a lot for the call.
Pretty pricey, but nothing like Park. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, 231-8187.
I don't know. With the generous salary I earn here at KBOO, I might be able to get a Park.
Yeah, with your generous salary at KBOO, along with your other, we don't tell them where it is, generous salary, you should easily be able to have a Park Avenue penthouse.
Indeed.
All right.
Edith, good morning.
Good morning. This topic this morning connects a lot of the life-transforming experiences I've had that I thought if I shared can help folks get some hope and perspective and some strategies and not be...
No, that's good. Hope and strategy are all good.
So when I was 13, my mom handed me a postcard of two wolves' faces, cheek-to-cheek looking real snuggly, because she was a painter and would draw whatever images she could come up with. And that began my writing saying, don't drill in the Arctic and all the harm and species that are going extinct every day.
Yeah.
That was, I'm now 55. And then when I was in 1981 and 82, I bicycled across the United States into Europe, and in Europe, Brussels, Belgium, I was working for a family with a man who was mapping for NATO all the oil and natural gas reserves in the world, because that's where they were going to have wars. And so in May 1982, I knew what were the planned dates of what wars in what countries, and all that has come true except for Venezuela.
That got messed up by Hugo.
And then they made some attempts. Anyway, where I was talking with some folks who were, got in with someone who just was part of families who for 850 at the time, years, had ruled the world. And so even though I was their cute little, adorable, they wanted to adopt me, American, but they were educating on what's going on. They knew that global climate change or chaos was a greater problem than terrorism or conventional wars. They knew this in 81 and 82. And the papers that the different intelligence agencies presented to the United Kingdom, to Germany, to Russia, and to the United States, I don't know who else, were all elaborating how this domino effect of climate change resulting in mass starvation and mobilization and migration and revolutions, people being desperate. So back in 81, when I got a ride with this guy taking me to Amish, Pennsylvania, Dutch country, was the archivist of the Library of Congress, and he was writing a book on the secret government. I didn't realize at the time, I was so naive and stupid, I was a very loyal, patriotic Republican. I mentioned to some church friends at a big party in Washington, D.C., rich and powerful, and they said, well, weren't you bored, or was it kind of scary and dangerous bicycling across the country? So, oh, no, I meet all these interesting people by being alone, that I wouldn't meet if I were in a group, for example, and I gave that man's name.
Uh-huh.
That night, he was murdered, and all of his book and all his
resources
were destroyed. I feel very guilty about that. And I had been trying to speak up and tell folks. For example, in 85, I was trying to tell people, and I got a lot of squashing down on me, about Four Corners, where people
claim they care about
peace. They claim they don't want
They don't want the coal.
Uranium, and they don't want coal, Peabody coal, the water. So I'm telling people about how the water, we're in peak water, peak oil.
Mm-hmm.
We're having uranium contamination. We're talking about these terrible bad petroleum and coal companies and what they do and how they terrorize, and the combination with the PE, FBI, et cetera. And under the ground from, for example, Denver, there's this huge, gigantic tunnel system where these rich and famous are planning to have the underground thing. Well, if I didn't read comic books, I didn't watch crazy, I don't have a TV, this stuff I could have never imagined or dreamed up. It's just too bizarre, and I avoid those kind of things. But real people in real life with real evidence, who most of whom got murdered, there's a dear woman here in Portland who's been a part of the counterintelligence, letting the public know about planned false flags, was killed. And she was part of exposing what was planned here in Portland, having the 10-kiloton nuclear warhead on Savi Island and the different radioactive releases for dirty bombs. It'll be blamed on environmentalists, primarily environmentalists, but also always getting a little bit of the Muslims because they have land that has oil. And it was Teresa Mitchell, for example, who picked up some of that information from cable.
We need you to coalesce this line of thought here.
All these different ideas of real-life people. If I'm a nobody, I'm a nothing nobody who's been pretty homebound, don't go very far, and I'm meeting all these people in real life who are telling me about Algerian military that have been on active duty in Oregon forests, if I'm meeting real life people with real evidence, real facts I see with my eyes, and they're not, and they know about it, and when I mention it to middle class white folks, they don't want to believe it. It's not that Obama doesn't know better, is in denial. It's that the rest of us can get out of denial.
That's absolutely,
I think you're
true.
Absolutely correct, and I'm going to let you go now. Because Bill McKibben has shown up early. The man's ahead of his time. Oh, that's a good pun or something. And
it's a pun.
It's a pun. Bill, welcome.
Very, very good to be with you guys.
Hey,
yeah, thank you for joining us.
Now, folks, those of you listening, we will take calls after a bit, but I want Bill to get a chance a little bit to talk about his book and what he's going to be doing here. And I'm going to want to ask you some weird questions.
You far away.
I'm going to start out.
All right.
350.org. That means, as I understand it, that when you have 350 particles of CO2 in the atmosphere
per million.
You've got a problem.
Jim Hansen at NASA, who's our greatest climate scientist, and his team did a paper in 2009. What they said was, we know enough about carbon in the atmosphere to know how much is too much. Any value for carbon greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's strong language. Stronger still, if you know that wherever you are today, Portland, Prague, Peoria, the atmosphere is 400 parts per million CO2 and going up about 2 parts per million per year. So we're too high.
Well, wait a minute. 350, now we're 400.
Mm.
Well, isn't it too late?
It's too late to stop global warming. That's no longer one of the options. It's not too late to keep it from getting worse than it would otherwise be. I mean, we've raised the temperature 1 degree Celsius on this planet already. That's done considerable damage. The Arctic has mostly melted. The ocean is about 30% more acidic than it was before. But the same scientists who told us that would happen are clear that we'll raise the temperature 4 or 5 degrees in this century unless we get off coal and gas and oil very fast. So, I mean, it's like saying, yes, it's too late to keep you from catching pneumonia and it's going to be miserable, but maybe we can, you know, keep your lungs from filling with fluid and you keeling over.
Okay. I think that makes some sense.
Okay. I think we're going to step aside and hang ourselves now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, so you're talking a sustained period of time above 350 parts per million in the atmosphere of CO2.
Yes.
Essentially, we will alter the conditions that led to our own evolution.
Yeah. As we go forward now in the years ahead, we're heading into CO2 levels higher than at any point in the course of at least modern primate evolution. I mean, it's already far higher than it's – one way to think of it is that we've already sometime in the last 20 years or so left the Holocene, left this period of benign climatic stability for the last 10,000 years that really underwrote the rise of human civilization. And now we're on to something else. And
the Anthropocene, if you will.
Maybe the Anthropocene was what we'll call it someday, the world made by man. But it's already a chaotic and destabilized place, and will get more so the longer we stick with this. I mean, we think that we have enough carbon already emitted that we're probably getting pretty close to a guaranteed rise of 2 degrees Celsius. And that's the line that the world agreed on that we would never go past. It's the only thing the world ever agreed on. Even, you know, China, even the U.S. signed on to that target. But we're headed directly there. The last year I wrote a big piece for Rolling Stone, and it was all about this sort of emerging math. If we're going to stay below 2 degrees, the scientists tell us we can burn about 500 gigatons more carbon, 500 billion tons between now and 2050. The problem is the fossil fuel industry, it turns out, if you look at all the SEC filings and annual reports, has in its already declared reserves about 2,800 gigatons of coal and gas and oil, or five times what we can burn. So if they follow their announced business plan, the planet tanks. I mean, that's why they're a rogue industry. That's why we're pushing so hard for divestment now around the country and around the world. It's why we have to really understand them as an adversary at this point.
Well, I actually have a question about that.
I
raised it earlier before you came in. But look, let's say I'm a billionaire in the energy industry.
I didn't know you were, but let's.
Well, I do. That's why I'm here.
That gives us more leverage.
Yeah.
Okay.
I am that. I have children. I have grandchildren. I even have great grandchildren.
Yes.
Because I'm 80 and very wealthy. Now, I'm willing to apparently, despite all the evidence, make the world a worse place for those kids.
True.
What's the logic? What's the rationality of wealthy people being willing to destroy the very world in which they live?
I think that if they're able to take on board the information, which, you know, a certain number of them aren't. If you're a real ideologue, it's difficult to get new information into your brain. But if you are, I think the assumption is, I will have made enough money and my kids have made enough money, whatever, that we'll be insulated from whatever's going on.
So it's as simple as that? We'll be protected in our cocoon of wealth?
I'd say, yeah, that comes pretty close.
Well, you know, to me, that is a real puzzle. I'm looking at all this. Now, the Keystone XL pipeline is or is not going to be built. You've taken it as both symbolic and real example of foolishness.
Mm.
This is bitumen. This is the worst kind of oil.
Mm.
And it takes an enormous amount of energy to extract it. It creates itself greenhouse gases. It goes across the country, probably going to leak because I don't know that the oil industry is very responsible in its pipes. It shows up in Port Arthur or some other port in the Gulf and then is shipped to China where it's burned. Or India, where it's burned, and then all of the poisons from that burning come back here. Do I understand this correctly?
You did a good job. Secondhand smoke from carbon is every bit as dangerous as firsthand smoke. Carbon dioxide is a globally mixed gas, and so it makes no difference at all where you burn it, and it raises the temperature with equal effect for the globe as a whole. So that your scenario is exactly right, and it explains why this has become a real rallying point, the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country and the kind of iconic environmental fight of our time.
Well, what happens? Okay, two scenarios. Obama's better nature makes him decide to block this, even though the southern part of the thing's already been built.
Yep.
That's the scenario number one. Scenario number two is he says, well, you know, in the movement union, let's do it.
Yep.
What's going to happen? I mean, can he get away with it? Number one, will it really happen? We got a dysfunctional Congress. We don't seem to be able to govern ourselves on any issue, let alone global warming.
Scenario number one, he does the right thing.
Uh-huh.
It's not as you point out, a complete victory. They've built parts of this pipeline. They're building many other pipelines, but they can't build pipelines across the Canadian border and bring new tar sands oil in without permission from the president. And if we were able to block this, it would put a huge crimp in the plans for expansion of the tar sands oil barons, people like the Koch brothers. That's the reason that our indigenous allies, First Nations allies, who have carried this fight longer and harder than anyone, that's why they're so committed to blocking it. And it would mark the first time in world history that a leader had said, we're not going to build something big because of its effect on the climate. That precedent would be extremely useful. Among other things, I think it would help reopen the international negotiations about climate that have been shut down since Copenhagen. If the president does the wrong thing, then we say, I'm afraid, as on many other issues, this guy is a lot more talk than action. And it helps us understand that even the president of the United States is pushed everywhere by the fossil fuel industry, at which point we, I think, redouble our focus on going as hard after that industry as we can, push the divestment message and things even harder and faster.
What is it about tar sands oil that's particularly egregious?
Well, there's two things. One is it is particularly dirty. It's all bound up with sand, and so you have to heat it up to release it before you can put it down a pipeline or into a truck or anything. And that takes a lot of extra energy. So in carbon terms, it's a whopper of an energy source. The other problem, the even bigger problem, is simply that there's just so much of it up there. It's one of these six or seven pools of carbon around the world that are so big that if we tap into them, as Jim Hansen said, game over for the climate. I mean, if you burned all the economically recoverable oil in Alberta tonight, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 would go from 400 parts per million to 540 parts per million. That would mean we could cease having interesting discussions about climate change and move on to something else.
We could cease having discussions about anything
about anything in general. But it's just as important that we have the that we block coal trains to the Pacific Northwest, because the Powder River Basin in Montana and Wyoming has an equal or even greater amount of carbon stored there. That's why it's so good to see people doing their best to block those coal ports or the oil port in Vancouver, Washington, or all the efforts to stop things that make it easier to get crap out of the ground. The Pacific Northwest has emerged as a kind of strategic bottleneck, a cork that we can put in this bottle. The geography of the Pacific coastline means that they have relatively few options for building deep water ports to get this stuff to Asia. So people who are fighting them are fighting a really heroic battle at this point.
Well, I look at this as a major issue, and perhaps the most important issue in environmentalism right now. But there are other things going on, and Cornucopia, I don't know if you know that organization, is working very hard to keep organic farming truly organic, because every time there's an issue of writing the rules, various agencies of the government attempt, with the connivance of the major food industries, to water down the definition of organic. So we see that over and over again.
We're moving out of my area of expertise here.
I understand.
I got to say, for me, the biggest challenge, I think, going forward for organic farming, indeed for any farming, is what we're doing to the weather. I watch in Vermont, where I live, where we've built, as in Oregon, one of the great local food networks and things over recent years. There's always issues like the one you're describing, important for people to work on them. What happened 2 years ago in Vermont was we had the greatest rainfall in our history, the kind you can only get now that we've, by warming the air, let it hold more water vapor. That huge flood washed away not only roads and bridges, it washed away many of our beautiful organic farms that people had spent the last 25 years building. All that soil became, in a matter of minutes, rocks and sand. I'm afraid one of the problems of climate change being the size that it is that it tends to lead you to triage a fair number of other things that we probably should be paying a lot of attention to, but that become very moot if we don't get this one under control.
So the story of industrial civilization is essentially the story of the energy used to power it. And over our history, over the last 150 years or so, that energy has come almost exclusively from big hydrocarbons that have been fossilized under the earth for many millions of years. So my question to you is this. Absent this cheap and fairly easily obtainable source of energy, how do we transition away from that while still maintaining the many benefits of industrial society, longer life expectancies, better nutrition across a wider swath of the population, the revolutions in communications and transportation, and on and on and on? How do we get off this stuff while still keeping the good stuff that we've managed to accumulate?
Well, some of the things we don't necessarily get to keep. I mean, it's hard to imagine a planet that took climate change really seriously where jet travel was ubiquitous, you know. But happily, we live in a world where there's some compensations for that. In my time on this planet, we've watched the rise of the internet, which gives us ways of being interconnected without getting on United, you know. Mm-hmm. United without United, as it were. The answer to the larger question is it's a very difficult transition because we're moving, as you say, from centralized, BTU-rich, dense energy forms to omnipresent but diffuse ones, wind, sun, things like that. And what it really implies is a very, very, very different mindset. Instead of centralized energy generation, what the engineers call distributed generation. 10 million solar panels on 10 million homes all hooked together in a grid. Some big solar farms out in the desert, windmills where we can put them. Millions of these things everywhere. We think it'll work. There was a study in January at the University of Delaware. They looked at 350 billion, I think, weather conditions over the last century and found that if you built out a strong solar energy grid across the continent by 2030 at a cost relatively comparable to fossil fuel, you'd be able to provide about 99.9% of the electric reliability we have now. And we can see it beginning to happen in places that have taken this halfway seriously, Germany being the one big example. There were days this summer when the Germans generated half the power they used from solar panels within their borders, you know, and that should give heart to Oregonians because Germany's not exactly sun-splashed right, either, right. You know.
Yeah, I have a question, though, and I've heard this a lot from old-style, that's not fair, from many traditional leftists, which is, look, what you're talking about is taking away jobs, destroying the vast industries, leaving people who already have had their fortunes reversed by recent capitalist moves. And you're saying to them that, well, there's no more living wage jobs. It's not going to happen.
So what jobs are you thinking about?
Oh, well, I'm thinking about jobs in the conventional industry, building pipelines, developing
power
plants.
So pipelines are a good example because we know a lot about the jobs thing on it. It would take – it'd provide couple thousand jobs, people think, for 2 years as they built the pipeline. And after that, it would take about 35 people to run the Keystone pipeline. That's why you build pipelines, so you don't have to employ anybody. The jobs revolution comes when we make the serious transition onto renewable energy. Nobody is going to send their house to China to get it properly insulated. It's going to have to be done here. It's going to have to be done by the same guys who were swinging hammers building McMansions, 6 or 7 years ago. work that probably isn't coming back because we actually have a lifetime supply of McMansions out there.
I like the image, by the way, of a lifetime supply of McMansions. It's a very, yeah.
I think that's the way to look at it. There's a really happy intersection on the horizon if only we play our cards right. The biggest political and economic problem we're facing in this country is long-term unemployment. The biggest environmental problem we're looking at as a global community is global warming. So it seems to me that when those two threads intertwine, there's a lot of money to be made.
Well, let's hope. I mean, one should add that even if there weren't, and even if it made our employment problems worse or whatever, we still have to deal with it. Because in this case, you know, it's not like most political questions, which are debates between various groups of human beings, where we compromise and reach some. In this case, the basic underlying debate is between human beings and physics. And physics is implacable.
Yeah, it'll win every time.
It doesn't negotiate. So we need to take some cognizance of that.
Well, I am puzzled by – well, I'm not really puzzled. I'm saddened by the fact that most people in their daily lives are, in terms of their behavior and perhaps in terms of their thinking, unaware of the impending crisis. And if they're aware, are willing to dismiss it as just another problem, like as the Soviet Union was long ago, if you follow me, a political problem. And you're pointing out something that's really very important. You cannot argue with physical fact. But how do we reach, and I know you're, I don't mean to be critical of you because you're doing a lot of work, which I really honor, but how can we make ordinary folks in their ordinary lives watching ordinary stupid murder mysteries on TV become aware of what's really going on?
Well, you know, I mean, it's starting to happen. The polling data is really actually quite good now on the percentage of Americans worried about climate change. I wish I could take full responsibility for the powerful educational efforts, but I don't actually think my books have sold enough copies for that to be the case. We've done a lot of education at 350.org. We've held 20,000 rallies in every country except North Korea. But I think the real educator here has been Mother Nature. 80-some percent of U.S. counties have had a federally declared disaster in the last 2 years.
Really?
Yes. And between drought and flood, it's been chaos out there. And you know, even if you're mostly attuned to watching, mayhem on TV, as you describe, we've got enough of that now to make an impression. I mean, last year when Hurricane Sandy hit New York, it looked like a movie. The Atlantic Ocean was pouring into the New York City subway system. Half the island was dark. The East River took over the streets of the Lower East Side. I mean, there were white caps on Avenue A. It was astonishing. And, you know, 4 days later, that radical rag Business Week had as its cover in bold black letters, "It's global warming, stupid." Would that it did not take a 2x4 upside the head to get the message across, but that may be what it takes.
The only place in the world where there's still a debate on the validity and the existence of global warming is here in the United States. And really, that debate is confined to a certain segment of the population. So what do you say to the people who steadfastly maintain that it's not caused by human activity, that this is simply another cyclical warming period in the history of the Earth?
I don't spend a lot of time saying anything to them because it's not a good return on one's time.
I would have to agree.
Most of the opposition at this point is rooted not in science but in ideology. People have a syllogism in their head that goes like this, I think. Markets solve all problems. Markets aren't solving global warming. QED, global warming, is not a problem. It's not very logical syllogism, but it's a comforting one if you're, you know, deeply ideologically inclined that way. That's about 20% or something of the population. We don't need them in order to make political change. What we need is some significant percentage of that 70% who does know that there's a problem to be actually out doing something about it. And the good news is increasingly that's happening. I mean, Saturday we had 215 demonstrations in 47 states about drawing the line on the Keystone Pipeline. I was in Seattle, and we had thousands of people in red shirts arrayed along the waterfront who were drawing a line against Keystone and drawing a line against the coal trains and coal ports planned for their state.
Yeah, I just want to quickly mention that we're with Bill McKibben and that you are going to be speaking tonight at the Newmark Theater, 111, that's 41, Southwest Broadway at Main, and at 7:30. There'll also be some people there from 350pdx.org. People, when they come in, might want to stop by and pick up literature.
350pdx is a great outfit, and you know, there's this is a very interesting movement. I know you guys are interested in movements, and
yeah,
this is a kind of new one. Looks different. There is no great leader or central organization. It's endless local groups of people all over the country and the world, many of whom are working on whatever their local problem is. The Chevron refinery in Richmond, California is releasing toxic gas. The coal trains in Bellingham will put coal dust through the town, but are linked and interconnected in such a way that they can come together for powerful global national action too. That's what we need. The fossil fuel industry is a sprawling adversary, and we need a sprawling resistance.
I think that's really an important point. Let's go to the telephones, give some people a chance to talk to you. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. I'm part of a little group here in Portland that's the Climate Jobs Committee, and what we're doing is we actually had an article group that read your article, Bill, on the terrifying new math.
Right.
And then almost all of us decided, geez, we've got to do something about this. So we formed this group, and we're related. A lot of the people in the group are part of the labor movement, or at least affiliated in some way, supporters of the labor movement. And so what we've decided to do is push for unite the jobs crisis and the climate crisis, and ultimately we're fighting for a World War II level of mobilization of resources and workforce to defeat this climate problem as much as we can right away.
I think that's exactly the right image to be bringing forward.
Yeah, we've been testifying at these coal hearings,
mm-hmm.
and what we do is say, you know, the people that are fighting for jobs are wearing green shirts or blue shirts, and the climate people are wearing red shirts. And we say we can't wear either one.
Mm-hmm.
We have to wear, last time I said I had to have a purple shirt because it's red and blue. And you can see, you look at the audience of people that are fighting for jobs, and you can see that they hear you. You know, they're resonating with that message.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I'm not sure about the triaging. It seems to me that the mobilization, like World War II, can unite healthcare.
I completely agree with that. I completely agree with that.
Everything.
I think we broad coalition.
Yeah,
and it's been fun to watch the labor movement in particular really start to understand this. I mean, for understandable reasons, the pipeline fitters union and things wants to build pipelines, but an awful lot of the rest of organized labor has broken with that and come out, say, in opposition to Keystone. One of my favorite moments of the last few months was being with the heads of the National Nurses Union as they took on very feisty ways Chevron and said, look, we're tired of treating people who are dying from the stuff you guys are putting out. Time to have some healthy energy, too. So I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, is Dave still there?
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I really appreciate the call. If you can give us a way to reach general public. Oh, Dave, are you there?
Yeah.
Listen, just really quickly, how do people get in contact with your organization?
Okay, I'll give you a phone number and an email.
Okay.
The email is LANDD.
Okay, LANDD.
Underscore the numeral 2.
Yeah.
At Q for Quest.com.
Okay.
At Q.com. Okay.
Yeah. And the phone number is 503-286-5850.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the call.
I love your show, and I love you, Bill McKibben.
Back at you, brother. Good work.
All right. Bye.
All right. Who's next, Steve? Bonnie, good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Before I have just some local announcements about climate actions.
Okay.
And I just want to thank Bill for his endless, tireless work. It means so much to me personally. Yeah. The next general 350 PDX meeting will be at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House at 4312 Southeast Stark in Portland from 3 to 5 on October 19th. And if you have questions about that, if people may call 503-705-1943. Also, about the Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance, actions against it, people risking arrest in nonviolent civil disobedience, there will be trainings this Saturday, September 28th and October 5th. To register for that, people go to www.nokxl.org. Again, www.nokxl.org. Or call that same old number, 503-705-1943. And please go to the Wednesday, October 9th hearing in Vancouver at the Clark County Fairgrounds on the Longview coal terminal.
Thank you very much for the call, and I hope people do that. I think it's very personal.
And that gives you some sense of the kind of level of activity, engagement, organization. You saw what I meant about this kind of sprawling movement. That's just what we need, and exactly that same thing's going on all over the world now.
Yeah, you know, it's really
bigger.
Yeah, thank you for your work. It's really very.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, it's really very cool that people like me, who for years were involved in a variety of environmental and social justice issues, I no longer have to know exactly what's happening all the time, because when I was young and involved in all those things, it was very centralized. It was very, you could clearly, you know, 7 or 8 people you could reach out to in New York or wherever. Now, as you said, Bill, it's all over the country, and we cannot measure it by the conventional means of counting. It's in the, I would almost say in the blood. It's in the spirit and the soul of American people. I think people are catching on.
Let's hope. It's a race at this point. Physics is well ahead.
physics always wins.
We'll find out. We'll find out. We're doing our best to accommodate physics and catch up. The Keystone thing will tell a lot how that comes out.
But I guess nobody knows what Obama's going to do. But I'm wondering what your take on his situation is right now.
You know, I've never been inside the White House. Well, that's not true. I took a tour when I was in sixth grade. I've spent a fair amount of time chained to the gate outside, but that's, you know,
that doesn't count.
I have outside information, not inside information. I don't know. You know, the harder we push, the better our odds. That's my guess.
You know, you hear the man speak, and clearly he knows what the right thing to do is. He knows what the physics is. So I think this whole thing is, you couldn't ask for a more glaring example of the depth and breadth of the influence of the petrochemical industry. How deep in the pockets must high-ranking members of both parties be such that he can't even say a simple word like no?
The Keystone thing is very funny, because once everybody started looking into it, I mean, it just turned out that they had hired every operative in Washington. I mean, talk about jobs. The resistance to Keystone's been like a full employment act for lobbyists in D.C. You know, the bad guys are paying anybody, because that's all they've got. They've got all the money in the world. I mean, literally, You know, Exxon made more money the last 4 years than any company in the history of money. Okay, but that's all they've got, and so we do our best to find other currencies to work in. You know, passion, spirit, creativity, currencies of movement. That so far has been enough to hold them at bay, despite the hundreds of millions they've poured in.
Yeah, I actually am sort of hopeful that the better nature of Obama will make him decide to do something that is not the most politically secure or safest thing.
I actually think politically, if he wants to win the 2014 midterm elections, he probably better figure out something to rally his base to get them out, and this would be something.
I wouldn't mind if we appealed to his worst nature. Like if we said to him, hey, man, your ego will be gratified forever if you become the man who the first environmental savior. You know, I don't care. I don't care if he does it for the basest of reasons.
Well, Bill, I want to repeat once again, tonight at 7:30, you're going to be at the Newmark Theater here in Portland. And that's on Broadway. It's not at Powell's Books, even though it's a Powell-sponsored event. So it's 1111, the Southwest Broadway at Main at 7:30, and there'll be tables set up by 350pdx.org. And I would really urge people to come to that. I think it's very inspiring, very important, and kind of fun.
It'll be as fun as my grim...
Well, you're very dour.
Visage
you're
can
very
make
dour.
It. Yes.
Let's take a couple more phone calls.
Okay.
Harvey, good morning.
Hi, Abe and Joe. Thank you very much for this show, and thank you, Bill, for being the leader you are. I really appreciate it. To me, it's all about the water. You know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, are second to only to agriculture in their daily use of our freshwater resources. And what's happening is that they're producing the CO2 that's diminishing the snow caps on our mountains, and at the same time, it's melting the polar caps, so there's salt intrusion into the land. At the same time, fracking, they're poisoning the groundwater, and here's the worst. With the Fukushima plume heading in our ocean toward the west coast, we're several desalination plants are coming online, and I'm wondering if those desalination plants can take out the radioactive material out of the water. So everywhere we turn, the four horsemen of the apocalypse are coming down on us.
That's right. And you haven't even mentioned, in a way, the toughest of all of this in terms of water, and one that should be particularly appropriate here. The ocean is acidifying at an astonishing rate. The ocean is 30% more acidic than it was 40 years ago.
Wait, 30%?
Oh, my Lord.
Its chemistry changes as it absorbs CO2 from the atmosphere. And so, as you know, along the coast of the Northwest, we're already seeing, the oyster farmers and things are having a very tough time. Their larvae can't survive in those kind of waters. So they're moving operations and trying to figure out fixes and things. There was a absolutely crackerjack series of stories in the Seattle Times last week on ocean acidification and what it means. I encourage people to go look it up.
So I just want to say one more thing, that solar panels, once manufactured, use no water over the 20 to 25-year warranty of their lifestyle. And I say it's time to get star-powered. Let's get solar. Thanks, Bill.
Amen.
Hey, thanks very much for the call. Who's next, Steve? Michael, good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, wait, Michael, hang on. I just have to warn people. Tell people this is a ticketed event tonight. So, it's important that people be aware of that. I didn't want that to be misunderstood.
Oh, you can visit pals.com for ticket information.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Michael. Sorry.
Okay. I'm going to be the only skeptic about global warming that's on today, and I just want to say one thing because I can tell that I don't have much time. Bill McKibben mentioned Hurricane Sandy.
Yes.
Hurricane Sandy was a weak Category 1, the lowest category hurricane that there is. It took a left turn and happened to hit exactly, the storm surge hit exactly at a lunar high tide.
You're absolutely right. Global warming is a hoax, clearly.
Oh, we have to, Michael, we can't discourse with you at this point. Bill McKibben, I'm really glad
Thank you guys very much for having me in. Just note that Hurricane Sandy was the lowest barometric pressure ever recorded north of Cape Hatteras.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Thank you, Bill.
Bill McKibben tonight at the Newmark Theater, and we'll see you all. Stay tuned to KBOO. We the people that will keep the fight going.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, host David Barsamian speaks with documentary filmmaker Sanjay Kak about Kashmir, Hell in Heaven. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, featuring an encore broadcast of a speech by reporter and author Jeremy Scahill. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Demay Roberts looks at Oscar Wilde's lesser-known fairy tales at Shaking the Tree Theater, plus Defunct Theater's Biting Play, the submission about racial appropriation and art. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews New York artist and curator James Gallagher. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support, and thanks for listening. Our website is back up. Please go to kboo.fm to check it out. Now let's go to Alternative Radio.